this is much broader than just a timber issue, and it's important that we go through a process where we hear all those voices.
A new look at how the roadless rule applies to Tongass National Forest. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 2nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the governor's climate task force releases a draft of its plan, and the proposals include a carbon tax.
The reality of our life circumstance will ultimately determine how Alaska acts, and I'm confident that Alaska will do what's right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
The Alaska Permanent Fund grew by more than $6 billion during the state's 2018 fiscal year, reaching a total value of nearly $65 billion. The Associated Press reports that strong market returns have bolstered the fund, gaining by more than 12% in 2017 and nearly 11% in the fiscal year that ended in June. The state will make a draw of about 5% of market value on the fund's earnings reserve account to pay down budget deficits and pay dividends. The draw approved by the state legislature earlier this year will be about $2.7 billion. About $1 billion will pay dividends of $1,600 to each eligible resident, and the remainder will be directed for the state budget. After decades of debate, Alaska is now one step closer to being able to build new roads in the Tongass National Forest. Timber industry groups have said new roads are critical for keeping the industry alive. Some small tour operators, on the other hand, want the Tongass to stay intact. The U.S. Forest Service announced today it signed an agreement with the state, officially kicking off that process. They'll be looking at the roadless rule and how it applies to the Tongass. That's the federal regulation most states have to follow that Alaska has been fighting for years. Chris French, who works in the Forest Service's Washington, D.C. office, says his visit to Alaska gave him some perspective.
Everyone had a slightly different opinion, and that made us say, this is much broader than just a timber issue, and it's important that we go through a process where we hear all those voices before we make any decision.
French says new roads could allow access for cell towers to be built and for mineral exploration. The Forest Service wants to finalize the details in less than 2 years, pending several rounds of public comment and an environmental assessment. In 2016, the Forest Service released a plan for the Tongass. It included phasing out old-growth logging and was created with years of community input. But French says that could change.
The reality is, yes. I mean, depending on what comes out of this, whatever that rule is, if it changes from the status quo, then we'll likely have to relook at that plan.
This latest announcement comes on the heels of a trip Senator Lisa Murkowski made to a timber mill last month with a top federal official. States like Colorado and Idaho have pushed for similar measures to build new roads in their national forests. Governor Bill Walker's Climate Action Leadership Team met today in Anchorage. The team just released a draft of its climate plan. Alaska's Energy Desk reporter Elizabeth Harbaugh was at the meeting and is here to talk about what happened. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Who was there and what was the tone like?
So this meeting was led by Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott and other members of the governor's cabinet there, like DEC Commissioner Larry Hardig. There were also representatives from kind of a wide range of Alaskan perspectives. You had people from the fishing industry there. You had people, you know, renewable energy advocates, and you also had people from the fossil fuel industry there. The head of BP Alaska, Janet Weiss, was in the room. And as far as the tone, I would describe it as congenial and bureaucratic. They kind of plugged through these items. There wasn't a lot of debate. They discussed, like, should we use will here? Should we use shall here? Do we call it the blue economy? Do we call it the ocean economy? And then every so often, kind of a bigger discussion would pop up, like, what is the role of natural gas in the kind of larger transition to lower emissions fuels as we're worrying about climate change? But there were not a lot of fireworks.
So a lot of different points of view. But what were some of the ideas that they all have to deal with climate change?
Well, they produced this big, fat, 45-page document that I have sitting in front of me here, and there are a lot of ideas in there. There's discussion, of course, on climate adaptation, talk about moving communities that are threatened by the impacts of climate change, whether that be sea level rise, storm surges, permafrost degradation. They have, stuff about promoting public transportation, and a lot of stuff about science and research, quite a variety. And then towards the end, you get to the sort of bigger ticket items, the items that more people are going to talk about, those being kind of setting specific targets to reduce emissions, which would fall heavily on the industry because they're sort of our bigger sources of emissions, and then putting a price on carbon, potentially a carbon tax. So those are the ones that you're going to hear the most discussion about, but there's a lot more than that in this document.
The carbon tax idea seems like a biggie, and there were people in the room from both the oil and gas industry and the coal industry. What did they have to say about this idea of putting a price on carbon?
Well, I did talk to Lorelei Simon. She was there representing the Usability coal mine. This is what she had to say about it.
I think a carbon tax is a horrible idea. I think it does nothing but redistribute wealth. It doesn't help grow the economy, and we will see a decrease in American spending money and jobs.
And that's sort of the sentiment you'll hear from pretty much across the coal industry, across the country, when you talk about putting a price on carbon. I also spoke to Janet Weiss of BP about this. She was more measured. BP, as a company, does support a global carbon tax. She cautioned that a state carbon tax might have some economic impacts that we should study. She didn't come out and say, like, this is immediately a terrible idea, but she did have some reservations when I spoke to her.
What happens to the team's climate change plan once it's finished?
So I asked about that. The draft climate action plan is going to be handed to the governor as kind of a menu of options for them to look at and potentially implement, weigh, study. This group is not a group that makes the law, that decides what is going to happen. And I think it's unrealistic to think that everything in here is actually going to happen. But this governor has said that climate change is something that he wants to take seriously. And so I think it's fair to say that he's going to give this document a lot of thought.
And of course, there's an election coming up. The governor's up for re-election. But what happens if Governor Walker doesn't get re-elected?
That's a really good question. I think it's a little up in the air right now, but I was at a gubernatorial debate a couple months ago, and Senator Dunleavy turned to Governor Walker and asked him, why are you prioritizing climate change when there's other issues out there like crime that Alaskans care a lot about? Governor Walker responded, I think this is a big issue, too. Today, I asked Lieutenant Governor Mellott that very question. What happens to this effort if the election does not go the way that you obviously would like? His response was sort of like, look, climate change is such a big issue. It's here. No matter what the next governor believes about climate change, she's going to have to deal with it.
You know, whether the governor and I are reelected or not, or someone is elected who is a climate change denier, the reality of our life circumstance will ultimately determine how Alaska acts, and I'm confident that Alaska will do what's right.
So there's a lot to be determined as this plays out, both on the ground as climate change plays out in Alaska and as our political system moves on the way it should.
Indeed, a lot to play out. Well, thank you for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
That was Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Fairbanks High School student may have discovered Alaska's very own earthworm.
In the interior, it wasn't glaciated, so that's why one of them might be native, because it may have survived the last ice age here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Representative Don Young held a forum with the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes Wednesday in Juneau. The congressman fielded questions from tribe members on issues affecting Alaska Natives. Several audience members spoke in support of efforts to expand tribal self-governance. Sea Alaska board member Jackie Peta said inconsistencies in what laws apply to Alaska Natives are a problem.
We support using the ISTA, the Indian Self-Determination Act definition, because it doesn't exclude one group or another, and certainly doesn't exclude Alaska.
The crowd recognized Young's previous work to expand Native self-governance, and he resolved to continue that effort. Harriet Brulett of the Chilkoot Indian Association brought up the issue of transportation funding. Right now, the federal government funds tribes based on road miles. This leaves a funding gap for Southeast Alaska tribal communities that rely on the ferry. Young was supportive of changing that.
I like the idea if the ferry system is included, why not?
Young was also asked about his feelings on the National Rifle Association in the wake of mass shootings around the country. Young is an NRA board member, and he said he doesn't think guns are the problem.
Is it the parents? Is it the phone? Is it the constant exposure to violence with no repercussions at all? I don't know. I can't solve it. But the gun itself, to me, the Second Amendment is still the most important amendment of all the amendments.
Audience members also brought up the issue of drugs in Native communities. Young described how drug addiction has affected his family. He shared an anecdote about his granddaughter, who's relapsed several times.
Within 2 weeks or 3 weeks, she falls back to those that she ran with before. And that just drives me crazy. The dealer is the one I want to eliminate. I can't do it legally, but that's the one I want to eliminate.
Young said that personal responsibility, as well as support services like halfway houses, have a role to play in keeping people clean. Prospective tourists have pledged to cancel vacations to Alaska if Senator Lisa Murkowski confirms President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. That's according to a letter sent to visitor bureaus in cities across Southeast Alaska. KHNS's Henry Leisha has more.
37 people hailing from 11 different states across the U.S. have added their names to the letter addressed to visitors bureaus in Skagway, Ketchikan, and Juneau. The short letter reads, "The undersigned pledge to cancel Alaska vacations and refrain from making any plans to visit in the future if Senator Murkowski confirms President Trump's anti-choice Supreme Court nominee." Travel Juneau CEO Liz Perry says she's seen this kind of thing before.
This is not uncommon in the industry. And as a matter of fact, the industry refers to this as the weaponization of travel, the threat of a boycott if a certain political end is not met. You know, such boycotts can be effective, but most of the time they mostly hit the frontline workers, your service operators, and that the political folks involved in this case U.S. senators are very seldom affected in a major way.
Perry says she wrote a letter back to its author, Shoshana Hantman, from Katona, New York. Perry encouraged her to write Murkowski directly.
I wanted to acknowledge her concerns and let her know what, generally our position was on the way boycotts can or cannot work, and invited her to take a different tack.
When reached by phone in New York, Hantman declined to comment for the story. Skagway Tourism Director Cody Jennings asked the Skagway Borough Assembly to consider the letter at its upcoming meeting this week. Murkowski hasn't said whether she'll confirm Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Her vote could be critical in deciding the nomination, since a single nay vote among Republicans, coupled with unanimous Democratic opposition, would sink the nomination. Perry of Travel Juneau says she sent a copy of the letter to Senator Murkowski's office in Juneau. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
A Fairbanks High School student may have discovered a new earthworm species. West Valley High School senior Megan Boyson conducted a first-ever survey for earthworms around Fairbanks last summer, an effort that yielded five species, four that were known and one new one.
The species that isn't positively identified as a European one, so it might be native to the United States, to North America, which means that it might be native to Alaska, but we don't know that for sure.
Boyson is lead author of an article about the discovery published in a July issue of Biodiversity Data Journal. Boyson, who worked with University of Alaska Museum of the North insect curator Derek Sykes and other scientists on the project, says more research is needed to better understand earthworms in the interior.
We'd like to expand the study range like all over the interior and get some more data from more varied locations.
Boyson says if worms are found in remote places, it's more likely they were not brought to the area by people and may have existed prior to the Ice Age.
In the interior, it wasn't glaciated, so that's why one of them might be native because it may have survived the last ice age here.
Boysen also points to the local worm survey as an important baseline as the climate warms.
Because you can compare it and see how the changing climate is affecting which earthworms can stay here and spread their range.
Boysen says the presence of earthworms are important to understand because they change soil ecology. Well, it's a question we've all been asked. What do you want to be when you grow up? To have an answer, you often have to know the possibilities. And for the first time, Alaska Native students were able to see the range of possibilities within fisheries and wildlife in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta through a decades-old science, technology, engineering, and math program. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
You're not supposed to rip the whole branch off.
Have you ever seen a moose munching on willow and wondered, what does that taste like?
Oh, that's sour.
I'm giant.
Middle schoolers recently chomped on some willow tips in Bethel Sandpit. They were taking an unconventional spin on an old study called a moose browse.
So 38 and a half for the base and then measure
Wait,
it.
No, never mind.
29.
Carrying measuring sticks and calipers, state wildlife biologists taught the students how to measure the amount of food available for moose. From there, they can estimate the size of the potential moose population and the number that can be harvested. The middle schoolers are the first class to attend a career STEM exploration academy outside of Anchorage with the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP.
And the theme for this career exploration was fish and wildlife, fisheries and wildlife. So it seemed like the perfect place.
Beth Spangler is the National Partnership Director for ANSEP.
There's a lot of subsistence use out in this region, obviously. We were just able to pull in a variety of different types of researchers and scientists and biologists that were able to explore the ideas with the students of having a STEM career in one of those fields.
All the students had attended a previous ANSEP Academy in Anchorage, and most are from the region.
It's overwhelming because I didn't know that had so much careers here in Bethel. My name is Brianna Henry. I'm from Bethel, and I'm in eighth grade. I knew there was fishing game, but I learned more about what they do and how they control the environment.
Scientists from multiple agencies and organizations from around the region participated. UAA college student Kelsey Panerk is an ANSEP youth peer mentor from Chifornik, a community where people haul water and use honey buckets. She initially majored in civil engineering to help bring piped water and sewage to her community. But after working more with ANSEP and then interning with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Panerk is changing her major to environmental science and biology.
To me, my environment and our animals are more important than like having running water, because we've been living without that for this long and we can go longer, but we can't really wait on the animals and the land.
In Bethel, Panerk cuts salmon as she studies fisheries while speaking Yukdun with elders. ANSEP's goal is helping students find a career path in a STEM field.
I feel like I've heard a lot of students say that, you know, there's not many jobs for me here. You know, I think I'm going to stay in Anchorage, and I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Janessa Esquible is the fisheries biologist for the Bethel Owensee Tribe.
I think this program was a good example of that, in which we have many locals working with, you know, within fisheries and wildlife.
Esquible hopes the students can follow paths to careers leading home to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
The world's largest collection of Yupik artifacts has finally arrived home in Quinhock, on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta coast. After shipping delays in Europe, the new Nalik artifacts have returned in time for the community's museum opening next week. More than 60,000 artifacts arrived in carefully packaged crates on Wednesday. The items date from the 1670s during the Bow and Arrow Wars, remembered still today in Yupik oral history. They were shipped from the University of Aberdeen in Scotland, where they've been cleaned and preserved. lead archaeologist Rick Connect teaches at Aberdeen. Over the past decade, he's led a team of local and international archaeologists to unearth the ancient items. The Quinhock Native Village Corporation reached out to Connect after the artifacts began appearing on the coastal shore in 2009. As masks, carvings, baskets, and more have been revealed, the discoveries have ignited a renaissance of craft making in the community. The former elementary school has been converted into a preservation laboratory, as well as a cultural center and museum. Next Saturday, August 11th, Quinhock will celebrate the museum's opening, the community's long history, and nearly a decade of hard work, and will do so with the complete Nunalik collection on display. It's expensive to remove household waste from rural Alaska, but one organization did just that for six communities on the YK Delta earlier this month. But as Christy Schallenberger from Alaska's Energy Desk reports, it wouldn't have been possible without help from Donlin Gold.
It takes a lot of money and patience to ship household waste from communities in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
We had to store them in a conex and wait for, you know, when the winter and the spring break and the barges to get here.
That's Anna Michael. She's the assistant coordinator for the Indian General Assistance Program, or IGAP, in Chuwathbulak. A program called Green Star removed the village's household waste for them earlier this month.
A lot of the landfills are just a mess in some of the communities, and the communities lack the resources and sometimes the technical assistance to help, you know, manage those sites correctly.
Doug Huntman is the program director for Green Star. It's part of the Alaska Forum, a nonprofit group that supports environmental efforts across the state. And this was the first time that Green Star has helped out the YK Delta. Before then, YK Delta communities stored household waste in a container and waited for the barges to come in the spring. Airlines are just too expensive, but even shipping it out can be pricey. Green Star shipped the waste through barges, but at a reduced rate, and it was supported in large part by Donlin Gold, the company developing one of the biggest gold mines in the world in the heart of this region.
And it wasn't until Donlin Gold stepped in and said, hey, we like your program with the communities, and we would be willing to donate some money, some funds to your organization if you could actually go out and clean up, you know, these materials in the communities.
Donlin Gold contributed $160,000 last year to make sure this happened, says Kurt Parkin, Donlin's spokesman.
This isn't intended to be a particular message. We are interested in keeping the Kuskokwim River healthy.
Green Star shipped the waste for six communities in the YK Delta: Upper and Lower Kauskag, Chuwathbulak, Napaimute, Crooked Creek, and Aniak. And all six are close to the proposed mine site. Donlin plans to participate in more cleanup efforts for the YK Delta communities next year, Parkin says, but details of that plan have yet to come together. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger in Bethel.
Most prisons in the country have commissaries. Those are places where inmates can buy food, clothes, and hygiene items. The money prisoners and their families spend go to private companies or the state, but not at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward, where the prisoners own the store. Reporter Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk tells us the story of how a few innovations are strengthening the community inside and outside the prison walls.
Now, we sell the single pizzas, which are $1.30. Hot pockets were $1.
Nick Showers Glover, an inmate at Spring Creek, rifles through one of the freezers inside the store. They're filled with everything from single frozen burritos to whole hams, stuff that can be cooked in a microwave, even if it takes a while.
But it's pure beef.
He moves on to the shelves lined with hygiene products, deodorant, toothpaste, shampoo. Like stores on the outside, they offer a variety to fit everyone's needs. Cheap bars of soap are 70 cents, but Dove runs $1.25 on extravagance.
Some people want, you know, it's soft on your skin and you get the smoothness, and I get it, I understand. But for me, Irish Spring does the job.
Spring Creek's store is owned and operated by the prisoners. They choose what to sell and what to charge. It's set up as a co-op, and different inmate-run organizations, like the Barbell Club and the Alaska Native Culture Club, each have a share in the profits. Spring Creek Superintendent Bill Lipinskas says when the prison opened 30 years ago, it was set up differently.
They started a store that was run by the state. It didn't work out.
The funny thing is, you put criminals in a store, then they don't own the product, they steal the product.
Money spent at the store didn't stay in the prison, and inmates couldn't see the benefit of protecting the resource. But for the past 3 years, all of the profits from the store have been reinvested in the prison to buy things like equipment for the gym and hobby shop and microwaves for the housing areas. It's donated to charities outside of the prison, too.
I can pull an inventory on that store at any given time, and with $100 on the table, I'll bet you they're not a candy bar off, because it's their store, they have the investment, it's their co-op, it's their community.
Items in the store come from Keefe Group, a private company that sells specialty products for prison commissaries across the country. According to the Prison Policy Initiative, prison commissaries are a $1.6 billion per year industry. In some facilities, the for-profit companies directly operate the commissaries and reap all the profits. In others, the state runs the store. In Seward, the store manager buys from the company in bulk, marks up the prices a little bit, and the profits stay in the institution. The model is very unique. Store manager Randy McDaniel says they want to make money, but they also want to help out their fellow inmates.
We try not to charge people a lot because, like, certain guys work in the kitchen. They only make 50 cents an hour, which maybe comes out to $40 a month unless you got to pay for cable or child support or restitution. So we don't want to rip people off. So we try to make their things as low as possible so they can afford it.
They also want to provide things that make people feel good, like Lucky Charms, nacho chips, and hamburger patties. McDaniel says the shelves are filled with things people request, not just what he wants. And people get excited to have access to soda and sausages. Inmates celebrate accomplishments like passing tests for the GED by sharing high-end items like chicken wings. They make state-provided meals more palatable by purchasing hot sauce and spices.
It feels good to treat people, you know?
Showers Glover, who's been in prison for about a decade, says it also feels good to be treated like an adult who can be responsible for buying his own things. The store sells clothing and shoes that are nicer than what the state provides and that haven't been worn by other inmates.
It goes a long way with just even feeling confident about yourself, you know what I'm saying, and helping you want us to reform and turn into a better person. Well, allow me to buy something that makes me feel secure, you know, and that's a new coat, that's a new shoes, that's a new pair of underwear. Underwear and socks, man, as mundane as that might seem, a clean pair of your own socks and drawers goes a long way.
He says people take good care of the things they buy for themselves or gifts from their families through the prison store. They take pride in them, just like the prison community now takes pride in the store. In Seward, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Jenkins and Jacob Steinberg in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Henry Leisha in Haines, Anna Rose MacArthur and Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Ann Hillman in Seward. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. Landing a job in Alaska's high-demand industries like welding, construction, medical billing, or marine transportation is now more affordable. The University of Alaska has reduced tuition for more than 300 career and technical education courses by 25%. From Ketchikan to Kotzebue, there has never been a better time to get started on your path to a new career. Learn more at www.alaska.edu/starthere. This message brought to you by the University of Alaska. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.